Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book building podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today to talk about our January 2022 book club pick, She Who Became the Sun by Shelley Parker Chan.
But before we get started, happy belated Lunar New Year, Marvin.
Right. It is the new year. Happy Year of the Tiger for everybody. Rira, I'm not sure if you celebrated, but I did celebrate with my family. I got some red envelopes because I'm still unmarried, which so I technically qualified. It's been an interesting year so far. Netflix raised their rates. The New York Times bought Wordle. So I don't know if this year is off to the best start, but...
I think everybody is of the general consensus of let's just hope that this year is not... like objectively terrible. Like let's just hope that it's a little bit better than the year before. But I have a good feeling. Year of the Tiger sounds like the year of the Koreans, because you know,
oh, that's true.
Yeah, we're the land of the tigers. So
let me offer you some New Year's greetings and a happy New Year. I wish you good fortune, good health, good wealth, and
same times. To you as well. Same to all of our listeners.
Yeah.
Whether you celebrate it or not. Actually, okay, so I don't celebrate it, but a lot of other Koreans do. A lot of Korean Americans do. So I've been seeing like pictures of them eating like rice cake soup and all of like the traditional stuff that they do with their family. And I messaged my parents saying like, oh, happy 설날, because, you know, I'm just trying to be a filial daughter, even though we're not like celebrating it. And my dad responded saying, oh, thanks, but I don't really care about the lunar calendar, but happy new year, I guess. Like, stay oh, no. well and healthy. Like, have fun, I guess. And I was like, wow, that sums up my entire relationship with Korean holidays.
That is sad and funny at the same time. I'm sorry,
I guess. I don't think it's something to be sorry about. I just thought it was very funny because, I don't know, like... people make it out to be such like a big deal in other Asian cultures. And I kind of feel left out in a way because it's like I kind of wish I had that experience, but I don't. The closest I've had to it was going to Korean school, and then they have like all of the like traditional activities. But that's at school, so that's not with your family.
It is interesting how the Lunar New Year has become this like pan-Asian American holiday that even like the mainstream commercial stores are now celebrating. And yeah, it's wild. It's a little wild, right?
Yeah, I mean, let me just say, like, the number of ads that I got from beauty product companies were like, this is our Lunar New Year like package edition of skincare stuff. And it's like, wow, how performative of you to celebrate Asians just on this one holiday.
We got the Lunar New Year and we got the month of May, I guess.
I guess those are the only two times Asians matter, apparently.
Yeah. Before we get started, I also wanted to quickly apologize to everybody who tried to buy a Books and Boba tote bag over the last month. We use a platform called Bonfire that creates order windows called campaigns. And sometimes if not enough people order our merchandise, the entire purchase order doesn't go through. And that's what happened to our tote bag orders of the last month. I received an email saying that all the orders have been canceled due to not hitting the order threshold. So if you tried to buy a tote bag last month and received that email, sorry about that. I have changed the tote bag settings to on demand, which means your order for a tote bag will go through the moment you submit the order. This means on our end, we're not receiving the benefits of the economies of scale, but I'd much rather you have your tote bag to go represent our book club than penny pinch on not making an extra like 20 cents on the bag. So if you did get your order canceled, you should be able to get your order through if you go to our Books and Boba Bonfire store now. The apparel orders went through fine. So if you ordered a Books and Boba t-shirt or sweatshirt, you should be getting those soon. But so yeah, hopefully now those of you who want a Books and Boba tote bag will be able to get one. I like to rock mine when I go to buy boba, just to be smug about it.
I use my tote bag as my main purse because I'm always just carrying a shit ton of stuff. So it surprisingly fits a lot of things. So yeah. I've been using that as my main grocery bag and my main takeaway bag. Pretty much anything you can stuff in it, I've been using it.
Yeah. And your support has helped us pay for about, I want to say, half a year of hosting for this show. So thank you for that support as well. And with that said, Rira, can you start us off with the book jacket summary for She Who Became the Sun?
All right. In 1345, China lies under harsh Mongol rule. For the starving peasants of the Central Plains, greatness is something found only in stories. But when Zhu family's eighth-born son, Zhu Chongba, is given a fate of greatness, everyone is mystified as to how it will come to pass. The fate of nothingness received by the family's clever and capable second daughter, on the other hand, is only as expected. When a bandit attack orphans the two children, though it is Zhu Chongba who succumbs to despair and dies. Desperate to escape her own fated death, the girl uses her brother's identity to enter a monastery as a young male novice. There, propelled by her burning desire to survive, Zhu learns she is capable of doing whatever it takes, no matter how callous, to stay hidden from her fate. After her sanctuary is destroyed for supporting the rebellion against Mongol rule, Zhu takes the chance to claim another future altogether, her brother's abandoned greatness. And that is a very good place to start our discussion, because that is part one of the book.
Yeah. I guess we're off the bat. What are your general impressions after finishing the book?
So we've read a couple of Chinese-inspired military fantasies. Marvin has read The Poppy War. We've read The Grace of Kings for this podcast, as well as Empress of Salt and Fortune. So we kind of know how these types of stories go, but it was very different this time around in terms of themes and I guess I expected the fantasy element to be bigger, but it was actually very minor in terms of like the narrative.
Yeah, the fantasy in this novel was pretty low fantasy. It's not like your swords and sorcery, but I did like how the book was recognizable as like an Asian, specifically Chinese inspired fantasy. You know, a Chinese fantasy epic spans a couple different spectrums. You have your books like Jade City and The Poppy War, where, you know, you're really following more characters and there's a lot more martial arts action. And then you have your more sweeping military epics like The Grace of Kings and Romance of the Three Kingdoms, where it's much more focused on big battles and politicking. What I love about Chinese epics set in these time periods is these are the times where you find like ambitious people who use the opportunity of the chaos of a waning empire to write their own destinies. Because during times of chaos, that's when heroes emerge. And that's when you have ordinary people with ambition able to find ways to gain glory through war and through battle.
Yeah, in terms of like comparing it to Grace of Kings, I mean, they're both very different books, but because, you know, we're talking about military fantasy inspired by Chinese dynasties, She Who Became the Sun is more character focused. So the cast is much smaller, and I think the plot is much more like digestible in terms of just like sitting through and knowing what's going on. Whereas with Grace of Kings, there are so many characters, so many factions, so much time passes. Although this book does a lot of time skips as well. But I really liked the exploration of gender identity, queerness, gender expression. We'll get more into that later, but it's a reimagining of the Ming Dynasty, or the rise of the Ming Dynasty and the fall of the Yuan Dynasty. So obviously there's going to be a lot of violence, because as with a lot of stories that take place at the end of a dynasty, there's a lot of rebellions and there's a lot of gore. So if you are, if you haven't read the book, just go into the book with that caution. There are some gruesome deaths that are depicted in the story. But I was not surprised by the ending, but apparently some people were on Goodreads.
Well, it helps being familiar with the story.
I think that's what it is. Like, you're not, I mean, I'm not very knowledgeable about the Ming Dynasty or the Yuan Dynasty, but like, just from the title alone, I'm like, oh, okay, like, Zhu is going to become the emperor somehow. Like, I see where this is going. But apparently a lot of people were very surprised that Zhu became the emperor.
Yeah, I mean, I was the same way. Like, I'm not as familiar with the rise of the Ming Dynasty. I'm much more familiar with the era at the fall of the Han Dynasty, because that's the Three Kingdoms era. But there's, you know, similar themes here where it's about people claiming the right to rule and dealing with political schemes. And the main character, Zhu Chongba, or the nameless Zhu daughter, she's characterized as someone of that archetype. She is a very ambitious and pragmatic person, willing to do whatever it takes to succeed, and is not above using underhanded tactics to survive and to win. Which I think in a way makes her like contemporaries with like the great strategists of like the Three Kingdoms era, like Cao Cao or Zhuge Liang, who are also characterized as pragmatic people who aren't afraid to use unconventional or underhanded tactics to win, even though it's seen as maybe cowardly or dishonorable by other people. In the same way, Zhu Chongba often uses her experience as a woman and her insights to find ways to win battles and secure her own survival.
Yeah, as with a lot of Asian period pieces, there's a lot of patriarchy and a lot of misogyny, and that is just unfortunately part of our history, and we're still affected by it today. So yeah. Reading a lot of the misogynistic language and just like the character's mindset of like internalized misogyny and sexism, I'm like, patriarchy sucks. Like, being a woman during this time period really, really sucks.
Yeah, I mean, the setup, of course, is Zhu Chongba is actually the real life warrior monk who became the first emperor of the Ming Dynasty. In the story, Shirley Parker Chan asked the question, what if Zhu Chongba was actually his sister? And I did enjoy the fact that while this is a gritty, gruesome military war epic, it also had, in a way, the heart of a cross-dressing narrative, because for most of the story, actually all the story, Zhu Chongba is trying to pass herself off as a man, and that tension of being found out is ever present. And there's a lot of dark tension in there, but it's also some moments of levity too, in terms of like the length she goes to maintain her secret, especially in the first third when she was in the monastery.
Yeah, I mean, with the cross-dressing aspect, I mean, we see it a lot in C dramas and K dramas, right? Like where
the bathhouse scenes and like the
bathhouse scene, or it's just like, oh no, like this prince figured out that I'm a woman and now we're falling in love. Like it's the typical trope, but I really like the fact that Zhu is she is non-binary in this very, very masculine space where she has to deny herself as a woman in order to be taken seriously. And that makes her very uncomfortable around other women. And I thought that was very interesting because she understands how much women suffer under the patriarchy. But at the same time, she's just like, oh, I'm not one of them. Like, It's like, I am Ju Chongba. I am destined for greatness. Like, I have none of that femininity in me that makes me feel weak. And that can come across as very toxic line of thinking. It's a line of thinking that a lot of people who are not well-versed in feminism believe to be all woke. But I think Shelley Parker Chan did a really good job exploring like gender queerness in a patriarchal society, because Ju is not the only person who has this, who's like in this in-between space, because the other character who is equally a protagonist is Ouyang, and he comes in the second part of the book. And actually, like, the first part is mostly told from Ju's point of view, but then as we go into part two, part three, it splits into different POVs. And that's really interesting because Ju's pronoun changes depending on the POV. So a lot of people who still consider her to be a cis man, they call her he. And there are times when Ju, you know, she calls herself herself in like female pronouns, but then when she is talking to other people, she addresses herself in male pronouns. So it's a very subtle way to play with gender that I thought Shelley Parker Chan did a really good job.
Yeah, I mean, Ju's character, I believe, self-identifies still as female, right?
I would say non-binary, because non-binary for like most of the book until she gets like the mandate of heaven, I would say. Because there's a lot of moments in the book where she's like, I'm like neither. Like, I feel like an alien, that I'm not entirely women, not entirely male. So it's really hard to say what she identifies as, but that's not, I would say, like, that's not the point. I think it's more of her exploring what her identity is and how that is tied with her ambition and her fate. Fate, ambition, shame, greatness, nothingness. Those are all like tied together in this one major, it's just something that a lot of the characters have on like on their shoulders the entire time.
Yeah, and I guess before we move on, I feel like we should note that both Rira and I identify as cisgender and hetero, so there might be some nuance to the storytelling and the allegories that we may have either missed or are not aware of, because while we can identify with the themes of living under Confucian values and being marginalized, there are certain intersections that we probably have blind spots for. So if there's anything that we missed during our discussion that you think is worth bringing up, please let us know. Let us know on our Goodreads group or on Twitter, because I'd love to know if there's anything that we may have missed.
Yeah, and I did my best to read reviews from queer reviewers who read this book. And a lot of them said that they thought the depiction of gender queerness and gender fluidity was pretty relatable. So, and also, like, Shelley Parker Chan is also queer herself. She considers herself under the pronouns she and they. And I know that when she was writing this book, she really wanted to write characters that kind of reflect her own experiences and her own journey in exploring sexuality and gender identity. So obviously that is a very big part of this book, and that kind of makes the whole story fresh, in my opinion. Because if this was just, like, I guess, a retelling of the historical fiction of the Ming Dynasty, like, I feel like I would not be as interested, because I don't know, just the fact that it is such a patriarchal society, and then you have a woman who is trying to pass as a man and to prove herself by wielding this male identity. It creates a lot of conflict and a lot of nuance, and I just feel like that would have been missing if it was just a straight up military fantasy.
And I did enjoy that, like, the point of her existence wasn't to become one of the guys, right? It was to chase greatness, is to, I guess, transcend her fate. And I thought that was a really interesting way to take it, because sometimes, you know, a lot of times with these cross-dressing stories, it's more about the hijinks than like the ambition, right?
Yeah, I mean, even with ambition, that's a little bit tied to gender, definitely, because in this society, they think that ambition is only allowed for cis men. Women should just be subservient and just obey and let other people decide their fate. And they're told not to want things, even though they're human, and it's a human trait to want things.
Yeah.
So having Ju being like, you're telling me as a woman that I'm not allowed to have a future. I'm not allowed to want greatness. Well, fuck that. I'm going to do whatever the hell I want.
Yeah. I like that, you know, this has been pitched as a Mulan meets the Son of Achilles. But, you know, Mulan took on her father's armor, as Disney portrays it, at least, to be a filial daughter and to save her father. Zhu assumes her brother's identity for, I guess, less selfless reasons. She just wants to survive, and she wants to shed her fate of nothingness by taking on her brother's fate of greatness, because her brother gave up on that fate, right? He decided to die in despair, whereas Zhu has this will to survive, and she believes that by assuming the fate that her brother gave up, she'll be able to also borrow that fate as well.
I mean, fate, like we said, is a pretty big theme in this book. And we see that with Ouyang, who is the Mongol general who is not actually Mongol. He's actually, what was the actual
It's name? Nanren, but basically he's Nanren, which means southerner, which is, I guess, a colloquialism for just Han Chinese. So he was Chinese.
Okay, yeah. And, you know, he's in a very unique position because, you know, he was forcibly castrated after his entire family was executed for being rebels against the Mongols. And he rose from being a slave to a general. So he's kind of occupying this in-between space, not just in terms of his gender identity, but also in terms of his like ethnic identity and loyalty.
Yeah. And I felt like it was such a like a C or K drama move to make like the antagonist like a very beautiful man, you know?
I mean, like with Ouyang, like if he could have easily been the sole protagonist of this book, you know, like I could totally see it happening. But I'm really glad that it was a dual protagonist story, because you get like a larger spectrum of queerness, because you have Ouyang who, you know, he has been denied his masculinity and people constantly tell him, oh, you're beautiful as a woman. And he freaking hates that because he's like, you know, it's like, I didn't choose to be a eunuch. It was it was forced upon me. And, you know, I'm a general and I'm cutthroat, but people still consider me to be a woman or a thing, not enough of a man. And I have to constantly prove myself. And his mindset is very like internalized misogyny, because he constantly thinks that women are like annoying and just like not worthy of his time. And he hates being compared to them. So yeah, if like Ouyang was like the sole protagonist of the story, like it could have been very limiting and kind of like a negative portrayal of a queer character who hates their identity. Whereas with Ju, I would say like her experience is more positive. There's less doom and gloom on her side of things. Whereas with Ouyang, it's like, I am destined to kill the people who killed my family. And I hate that this is happening because I'm secretly in love with the person who I've been serving for all these years.
I mean, let's talk about that. Like we mentioned, fate and prophecy are a big part of this book. Big part of just East Asian culture. You know, even these days we have, like, I don't know if your parents go see a fortune teller, but I know plenty of parents who go see fortune tellers. And even we just went through New Year, and New Year's all about luck and fate and fortune, right? And there's this idea, in especially during this time period, that fates are set, right? You can't fight your fate. If your fate is to be a hero. Your fate is to be a woman. Your fate is to be nothing. Like, that is something that is set in stone. And, you know, that tension that Zhu is trying to pass under someone else's fortune, that's her anxiety for like a good 2/3 of this book.
Yeah. And she literally sees ghosts as well. So that's kind of like a more literal sense of her anxiety, because she's always like, oh, the ghosts can see who I really am. They're constantly asking me who I am. So I need to not just pretend to be Zhu Chongba. I need to embody him and only make decisions that he would make. And of course, she breaks off from that the last quarter of the book.
Yeah. And, you know, the climax being Zhu Chongba as the character who decides to break away and make her own fate, ascends to greatness, whereas Ouyang, who is equally trapped within his idea that he has to follow his fate to the end, regardless of his own ideas about it, also does something audacious, but he still feels like it's out of his control. And, you know, Ouyang's fate is tied to his, like, again, he's still trapped under the power, I guess, of Confucian ideals, namely filial piety, like, because his family was murdered by the Mongolian invaders, by the Great Yuan, whether or not he wants to, he has to take revenge for them, because it is his fate that he's inherited from his ancestors, who literally crowd him, right? Like, he is constantly surrounded by the ghosts of his dead family members.
Yeah, and his revenge, I mean, he's been planning his revenge for years, but it's that moment, it's that battle where Zhu, like, rings the gong and has a landslide decimate, like, 10,000 of his men. And he's just like, well, I guess that's a sign for me to start plotting against my owners.
I mean, it sets him off because of that landslide, because of that military defeat, he gets sent home early and he's finally in a position to execute his plan.
Also, it helps that, like, Yisen's dad, what was his name? I don't remember his name. He doesn't stay alive for very long, but he degrades Ouyang, being like, oh, like, I took pity on you, like, you should be grateful, how dare you fail me. And Ouyang's
toxic fathers,
like,
are another trope in Asian literature. Yeah,
Ouyang's just like, fuck this. It's like, why should I be grateful that you made me a slave and made me feel like I am not worthy of respect? Like, fuck that, no, you're gonna die. So, speaking of Yisen, he was a pretty interesting character as well. If I would say, like, Zhu and Ouyang, they're like two sides of the same coin, I would say, like, Ma and Yisen are like the same. Because they're like the, not, I guess, love interests, but I feel like they're more than that. Like, companion?
I don't know if I would say they're the same, though. I think they provide different
parallel. Because, like, with Yisen, like, he comes from a position of power. So the power dynamic between Ouyang and Yisen are fucked up to begin with. And Yisen he's described to be, like, a very loving guy. But for a very loving, confident, charming guy, he says some really, like, shitty things to Ouyang, who he considers to be his best friend. He'll be like, oh, you're so lucky to not have to deal with wives, not knowing that it hurts.
I mean, he's just your typical, like, privileged dude bro, right? He doesn't see.
And he, like, completely forgets the fact that his family killed Ouyang's family. He's like, oh, we're good though, right? Because we're besties.
I don't know if he forgets. He just doesn't think about it. He doesn't think it's a big deal. Like, he is someone, like, because during this time, the Mongolians were the privileged class, where they were the conquerors. And, you know, Han Chinese during that time were essentially second-class citizens. So it's like they can't see the oppression because they are the oppressors.
But Ouyang still loves him. There is, like, a romantic interest there, but it's also laced in with a lot of, like, poison, because this is a relationship that is completely not balanced in terms of power and agency. And there's a moment when Yisen is drunk and, you know, he kind of makes a move on Ouyang and he says, oh, you really are as beautiful as a woman. And for Ohyang, it's like, it's really a slap in the face. It's a moment of humiliation because here's someone that he actually loves, but the person he loves can't accept him as, accept his masculinity and his entire gender identity. And then you have Ma, who is like the complete opposite. She's in the same position as Isen in terms of her relation to Zhu, but she accepts Zhu's identity. And I don't know, it just shows like the contrast of like how badly things could have turned out if Ma was a worse person.
I mean, Ma is also a woman, you know, in Imperial China, which means she is the second classist of the second class, right? And I think her character was interesting because she is just as clever as Zhu, just as smart, just as savvy. But because she is a woman, because she identifies as a woman, because she lives as a woman, she is constantly underestimated, constantly belittled, and constantly, just as Yisun is, you know, privileged and unable to see, like she is oppressed and unable to see her worth out of that, right? To her, her fate is to be a woman as a woman is supposed to be, like a good wife, a good daughter, and not being able to want for anything for herself.
Yeah, and like when she discovers Zhu's, when she finds out that Zhu is actually a woman, like she also starts to explore her sexuality. And I thought that was like a really beautiful relationship between the two. Like Ma is teaching Zhu that you need to have empathy. You can't just be cutthroat all the time because otherwise you're just going to end up like, what was his name? Chen Yulang or the other guy in her faction. Shoot, I totally forgot his name.
Chen Yulang, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you say that she's teaching Zhu empathy, but I feel like Zhu just has her around to make herself feel better about the shitty things that she does.
I guess, yeah. There is some, yeah.
I mean, I can see that she keeps Zhu a little bit more grounded. Like, her presence makes Zhu feel bad about the shitty things that she does, which I guess is a net positive at the end of the day, right?
At the very least, Zhu considers the consequences, right? Because otherwise, it would have just been like, oh, this is, like, I don't care. I'm just going to do whatever the hell I want to get what I want. Whereas, like, Ma's like, well, really think about this. Like, think about, like, how karma is going to get back at you for destroying people's lives, innocent lives. And from what I know, this is the beginning of a duology. So the second book is going to go into Zhu being the emperor. And I heard that there's going to be like more details on the ghost seeing and how that plays in with consequences.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about the light fantasy elements because She Who Became the Sun, I think, is classified as a fantasy. And like we mentioned, there are fantastical elements. But I really enjoyed the fact that all of the fantasy parts are kind of mundane. They're kind of just allegorical manifestations of Chinese concepts like hungry ghosts and fate between people being a prominent part of their lives. And the most fantastical thing in the story is actually the Mandate
flame
of Heaven, which, you know, traditionally is the justification tyrants use to justify their right to rule because, well, obviously I deserve to be emperor because I won the war, and so I am blessed by heaven. But in the case of She Who Became the Sun, the Mandate of Heaven is an actual physical flame that manifests to people who have received the right to rule China.
Yeah, the Mandate of Heaven flame was really interesting because when we look at history and people claim to be like the next divine emperor, like it's usually like, okay, like look at my bloodline. Like these are my ancestors. Whereas like with the Mandate of Heaven, it's just like, look, I have like this spirit flame in my hand.
The heavens have deemed me worthy of rule.
And there's like three people with the Mandate of Heaven. So we're just like, oh, like, so what does that mean? Like three people are worthy candidates to be emperor and you just got to pick your fave, I guess.
Whoever is willing to take it, right? Like in the world, the blue flame of the Yuan dynasty is fading, right? So, I mean, the Mongols are losing their mandate. So someone's got to step up. What did you think about I say twist ending, but it's only a twist ending if you didn't know the historical context beforehand. But what did you think about the what did you think about the fact that literally Lenny's the child emperor?
I mean, I knew that it was going to happen the moment the Prince of Radiance was introduced as a child. Because what is the easiest way to show how cutthroat somebody is in terms of getting power? You show them murdering an innocent life. And who's more innocent than, a cute kid with, nice peachy cheeks?
Was he cute, though? I thought he was pretty creepy.
He was cute. I mean, cute and creepy. I mean, this kid supposedly got reincarnated and remembers his past lives and whatnot.
I was forced to watch tons of executions.
I mean, listen, it's during a time of war. What kid hasn't seen some type of execution or death? But even though I didn't really... even though I wasn't aware of the Red Turban Rebellion, which was an actual rebellion during the rise of the Ming Dynasty, I was just like, he's gonna die. That's not a surprise to me at all. And it turns out with the Red Turban Rebellion, their mascot or whatever, the guy that they were trying to make emperor, he also got mysteriously
disappeared.
Lenny'd.
It was so hilarious that Zhu was like, hey, look at the pretty moon before stabbing him.
That was like a show of mercy, you know? It's just like the kid knows that he's gonna die, and he's just like, I honestly don't want to kill you, but I kind of have to in order to achieve my full potential. So let's make it easier on both of us and just not do our best to just not make eye contact.
How did you find the pragmatism of Zhu Tongba during the story?
As a very rational person myself, I was just like, yeah, that makes sense. If you're gonna this is Game of Thrones. If you want the throne, you're gonna have to kill people.
I like the fact that Zhu used everyone else's superstitions and preconceived notions against them because, oh, you believe all this bullshit. I'm going to use my rationalism to use that against you because I'm not bound by your concepts of honor or masculinity or fairness.
Nothing is fair in war. And also, speaking of, honor and stuff, Ouyang, when they have that fight in the cliffside and Ouyang chops off Zhu's hand and says oh, this is a fate worse than death because now you're less of a man because you can't wield a sword, your men are not going to follow you because you're disabled. And Zhu is just like,
joke's on you.
Sure, yeah. As long as I'm alive, no one can stop me. And it also comes from a place of her being well, I was considered a second-class citizen who had zero potential, but I managed to make it this far with my wits. So really having only one hand, it's just a minor inconvenience at this point.
It's just a flesh wound.
And then Ouyang is just what are you doing? Why are you back to commanding your army? Don't you feel disgrace? Being a commander that is disabled? And she's just it's fine. So there's this one character that we have not mentioned, but he is my favorite character in this book. It's Lord Wang. Wang Baoshang, the half-brother of Yi Sen. And I just love him because... the idea that I think he's half Mongol, right? Half Mongol and half Han Chinese.
He definitely has Chinese blood in him because that's why his dad hates him.
Yeah, his dad hates him because he's I don't want to fight. I don't, what is the point? You want men? Let me look at my accounting sheets.
Yeah, this guy is the smartest guy in every scene that he's in. And he just full of sass and
I love the sass. The sass is great. Them being aren't you ashamed of just, being smart and just reading the classics and admiring previous dynasties that we've conquered. Like, why are you wasting your time?
Where he's like, well, if I wasn't so smart, you wouldn't have armies to fight for you. You wouldn't have supplies. Yeah.
And I totally agree with that sentiment. So I'm just like, yes, I am all for this character. Like, he is my favorite. It's unfortunate with how his arc ended, you know? Well, yeah. Actually, it wasn't really unfortunate because he did technically get the last word.
Oh, he definitely went out with middle fingers to everybody.
Yeah, he did. So, yeah.
I did enjoy the glimpse into Yuan Dynasty court as well.
Like, it's interesting reading, like, their biases, like, them being like, oh, Chinese women with their tiny feet, like, so impractical. Like, why are they doing that? Or just like, oh, they're scholars. Like, the reason why they didn't survive, it's because they weren't man enough to learn how to fight. And it's just interesting reading their thoughts on that.
And, you know, this wasn't depicted, but I think I want to say that at the end of the Yuan Dynasty, the Yuan Mongols were also looked down upon by, like, the Mongols from Mongolia, because, like, you've been living in luxury in China all these years. You're not real Mongols neither.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting fact that I found out while, you know, wiki diving after reading this book is, I guess Korea was never actually conquered by the Yuan Dynasty.
No, we kind of had, like, a weird deal with them where we're like, okay, yeah, I guess we'll send our rulers and, you know, pretty girls to be your concubines so that you have, like, some influence in our court.
But technically, we didn't lose.
Yeah, well, we got conquered by Japan. But yeah, like, I knew about like, Mongolia and Korea, like, their weird relationship, because there's this drama called Empress Ki, and she was the, and like, her son was the king of Korea who was raised in Mongolia. So I remember seeing, like, clips of that drama and being like, oh, right, Mongols invaded us. Like, is there a country that they didn't invade? That was a thought that I had when I was watching that drama. But yeah, like, lots of wiki diving after reading this book,
yeah.
Which is very funny because it's not, like, meant to be historically accurate. Like, you do not read this book for historical accuracy.
But, like, I want to say more than half the characters that Shelley writes are based on real life characters, right? There was a real life Zhu Chongba, who was a warrior monk who became the first emperor of the Ming Dynasty. And he really did. Well, they said that the dynastic heir of the Red Turban Rebellion mysteriously died under Zhu Chongba's care, which I think, you know, he probably murdered that kid, right?
Oh, yeah, like 100% murdered that kid. But Wayang is a fictional character influenced by other historical figures, if I'm correct.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about Zhu Chongba's life as a commander in the Red Turban Rebellion, seeking her fate of greatness by pursuing glory. But we haven't talked much about the earlier arc in the story, where Zhu Chongba is a novice monk trying to find a comfortable life within the walls of the monastery while trying to maintain her cover as a boy while dealing with her power-tripping senior monk. I feel like the monastery arc was a really clever way of saying, you know what? People abuse power no matter where they are. You know, you're in this place where monks are supposed to be following Buddhism and being all altruistic, but there's just as much posturing and power tripping and corruption going on here as well.
I mean, like, okay, this is just, like, a small note, but when I heard that Zhu was going to go into a monastery, I was like, oh, okay, we're going to get some, like, battle montage, like, training montages, because I thought it was going to be, like, one of those
it's
fighting...
It's not a Shaolin monastery.
Well, because, like, it's a war book, right? It's a military fantasy book. So I was like, oh, man, like, she needs to get ready to be a badass general. Like, this is the beginning, but it turns out that her first battle, she beats 10,000 people with just a gong and manipulations. So.
Like I said, the trickster strategic genius general is pretty much a trope. And I mean, I'm going to paraphrase because I don't know the actual quotes, but a lot of Sun Tzu's Art of War is about how you win wars by not fighting, but by winning the battle before the fighting even starts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, the funny thing is, like, almost everyone on Zhu's side, they are all in it for themselves. Like, even the soldiers are just like, I'm here to stay alive. Like, as soon as it looks like we're outnumbered, I'm bailing. Just like, no way. And yeah, it's just like, it's a very interesting way to win a war, I guess. Because like, I expected more battles, but it was a lot of planning. It was a lot of politics and underhanded dealings. A lot of subterfuge.
What was your favorite battle?
My favorite battle, it was probably the walled city. Because it was just like, she goes in trying to convince the widow. Yeah, she tries to convince the widow, hey, can you kill like the new governor? But the widow is like, no, you need to kill him because like, I need proof that you are going to actually go the distance for me in order to like secure my future. So I'm like, oh, like that's a fun twist. And like you said, it's a heist. So I thought it was pretty fun to read.
Yeah.
What about you?
I kind of like the, I guess it was the most traditional of the battles, which is the decoy battle.
Oh, when Zhu gets like,
yeah, which ends in the duel.
Cut off.
Because they're both trying to like 40 chess each other. Like Zhu's like, well, I know what you're thinking, and I'm going to use that against you. And then Ouyang's like, well, I know what you think that I'm thinking, but joke's on you. I'm not even trying to win this battle. I'm just here to mess you up.
I mean, it's like interesting because like Ouyang is like purposely sabotaging efforts to like win battles. And everyone's like, why are you so incompetent at, you know, taking back this capital or defeating this army that is like very small? And like, he's just, like, in his mind, he's like, because that's what I've been planning, you fools. Like, do you really think that they would win if I actually took them seriously? So, yeah, it's a lot of subterfuge and it's really fun to read. I'm excited to read the second part because I just want to see Zhu's character arc and how her relationship with Ma is going to evolve now that a lot of trust has been broken.
Yeah, I'm also excited to see more of the clash between Zhu's pragmatism with Ma's idealism and also with Ouyang's fatalism. By the end of the book, Ouyang's still on his path towards his revenge, and he still feels that he has no control over his fate. And I wonder if he'll get out of that somewhere in book two, or if he stays with that till the end. I did enjoy the irony that both Zhu and Ouyang are each other's origin story in this book. Zhu started on her path to glory because Ouyang came and burned down her safe haven and forced her out into the world, whereas Zhu started Ouyang out on his quest for revenge by defeating his army and sending him home early, thereby creating the optimal conditions for his plan for revenge. So, yeah, I guess to wrap up our discussion of She Who Became the Sun, I really enjoyed reading this book. I did not come in expecting a historical Chinese military epic. For some reason, I thought it'd be more of like a wuxia tale, but I really enjoy this type of storytelling. You know, I watched a lot of Three Kingdoms growing up, and so I was glad to see a style of story that I was familiar with, even though I haven't seen it much told through a Western lens. Like I mentioned, I wasn't super familiar with the Yuan Dynasty or the Ming Dynasty, and so the supplementary wiki hole that I fell into was also a lot of fun. And yeah, I'm really excited to see where the story goes. There's still a few decades left of Zhu's reign as the first emperor of the Ming Dynasty, and the Yuan Dynasty has yet to be defeated yet, neither. Like right now, as the story stands, there's at least two or three other factions right now aiming to take down the remaining Yuan rulers, and Chinese history loves to build and break coalitions. So I wonder if we'll get more of the military campaign to take control of China, or if we'll just skip straight to the victory and focus on the reign of the Hong Emperor.
I'm not familiar with my Ming Dynasty history either. But I do know that the son of the Zhou Emperor undid a lot of the laws that the first emperor made. So they consider it to be like the second founding of the Ming Dynasty. So yeah, interested to see if any children come in the second book and we get some domestic drama in there, but we'll see.
Yeah.
But as for my final thoughts, I really enjoyed the characters. I really liked the fact that we had dual protagonists who were kind of foils for each other, who served each other as like their own origin stories. I love how there was a spectrum of queer identities in this book. Usually we only get one or two in fantasy books. And it's just nice that even in a setting that is very much known to be patriarchal and hyper masculine, you have these characters that are in between, and and it's like so subtle too. It's not, I don't think it's kind of like, I feel like with the characters, it just felt so natural how they like slipped into their gender expressions. So I think Shelley did a really good job in that aspect.
Yeah, and the way that they interacted with the world is really believable too. You can really believe that this is the way that someone who is trying to pass as a man or someone who is trying to hang on to his masculinity would act in, you know, these situations. I think the character work was really, really well done. And an effective way to introduce queer storylines in a genre where it's usually, if any, you know, confined to the subtext.
Yeah, I mean, I think we forget a lot of the times that queer people existed in ancient times. And I like to believe that there were definitely queer people like Zhou and
yeah,
in like the Ming Dynasty, the Song Dynasty. Like, there had to be a queer community. And
yeah, I mean, eunuchs are a big part of court life in Imperial China. They're the attendants of the empresses and concubines. And, you know, historically, they're characterized as like scheming politicos, which may or may not be tied to the lack of their perceived masculinity. But I'm sure these dudes got together all the time to talk about their identity and their place in the world now that people don't see them as men.
Yeah, I am all for books that are like, fuck the patriarchy. This ain't right. Do what you want. And I like the fact that we have a character who, you know, is cutthroat and isn't going to play by the rules. I don't know. Like, it just makes things much more fun to read overall.
Yeah. So I guess that'll do it for our discussion of She Who Became the Sun by Shelley Parker Chan. If you have any other thoughts on things that we talked about or things that we missed that you'd like to bring up, please let us know on our Goodreads forums. We always love to hear what our book club members have to say about our discussions and our book club picks. And I guess on that note, Rira, what are we reading for the month of February 2022?
We are reading Good Talk by Mira Jacob, and it is a graphic memoir. So we are going back into the graphic novel / graphic memoir territory. It's been a while. I thought that this would be a good pick because it's February and pictures are a lot faster to absorb than words.
It's a shorter month for sure, yeah.
And we also read like a very long book. So I thought that it would be a good change of pace.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm looking forward to checking that out. We'll be discussing that book at the end of the month. So please read along with us. But on that note, we've come to the end of this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you so much for joining us as we discussed She Who Became the Sun by Shelley Parker Chan. Rira, as always, thank you for hanging out with me and talking about books.
All right, everyone. See you next time.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Ryan, what's black and white and red all over?
I don't know, Roman. Two nuns having a chainsaw fight?
Dude, inappropriate. Come on, man. This is supposed to be a podcast promo for our secret underground podcast, Quarantine Comics.
Oh, yes. Quarantine Comics, the weekly comic book club where I, ace reporter Ryan Joe,
and I, mild-mannered Roman Settle,
team up to discuss some of comics' greatest works.
Or just some really cool comics that we've been wanting to read.
From Alan Moore to Uzumaki.
From Arrakis to Zendaya.
From Adrian Tomine to Jean Lun Yang.
You might not have heard of half the stuff that we're reading.
Or the other half is just pop culture superhero stuff.
They could just read the books with us, Ryan.
Yes, they could do that, but you could also just send us money.
No, Ryan, that's not how passion podcast projects work.
Why in the hell are we even doing this?
I'm sure we'll be back by next week's episode. So, tune in each week to Quarantine Comics. That's QTDComics.com. Set phasers to fun.